This episode is brought to you by Audi Canada.
The Canadian Medical Association has partnered with Audi Canada to offer CMA members a preferred incentive on select vehicle models. Purchase any new qualifying Audi model and receive an additional cash incentive based on the purchase type. Details of the incentive program can be found at audiprofessional.ca. Explore the full line of vehicles available to suit your lifestyle. The Audi driving experience is like no other.
Patients with irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, can have many uncomfortable symptoms. Thankfully, these patients may benefit from dietary modifications, drugs for symptom control, and psychological therapies. I'm Dr. Neil Cianciolone, Associate Editor for the Canadian Medical Association Journal. To tell us more about care of patients with IBS, I've reached one of the authors of a review article published in CMAJ. Dr. Adam Farmer is a UK-based gastroenterologist, senior lecturer, and clinical director of specialised medicine at the Royal Stoke University Hospital in Staffordshire, United Kingdom. Thanks for speaking with me today, Adam.
Thanks, Neil. It's a great pleasure to join you on the podcast.
To start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your interest in irritable bowel syndrome?
Sure. So I'm a practicing gastroenterologist in the UK, and some of my academic interests is around the pathophysiology and management of irritable bowel syndrome, which, you know, accounts for a huge burden of work in secondary care gastroenterology and trying to improve the outcomes and quality of life for these kind of patients.
And you also have a very active research portfolio in this condition as well.
Yes, both across the basic science of irritable bowel syndrome, but also in terms of clinical trials of new pharmacotherapeutic agents.
Great. So it makes you a really well-placed author to write the review article and for us to speak to today. So thank you. What is IBS and how well understood is the condition by family doctors, specialists and patients?
So irritable bowel syndrome can be thought of as a disorder of how the brain and the gut interact. And we used to call these disorders the functional gastrointestinal disorders. But IBS is largely characterized by an ABC, really. So that would be A for abdominal pain, B for bloating, and then C, some change in frequency or form of bowel habit. As I mentioned, IBS accounts for a huge burden of work, particularly in secondary care, with approximately 40% of new patient referrals in the UK. Although we have a good appreciation of the pathophysiology of irritable bowel syndrome, it is as yet incompletely understood, but it's thought to be, as I said, a disorder of communication between the gut and the brain. So what we refer to as the gut-brain axis, and this is a bidirectional circuit of communication between the central nervous system and the enteric nervous system in the gut, which can therefore give rise to bothersome symptoms.
And do you find that our understanding of IBS has significantly improved over the years, or what research has led us to our understanding of where we are now?
So our understanding has, I think, significantly improved over the recent past. If you go back to the sort of first descriptions in the literature in the 40s and 50s, it used to be called nervous colitis or spastic colon, and we certainly dropped the term colitis because there's no demonstrable inflammation within the gut. But there's an increasing appreciation of a number of factors that influence the pathophysiology of IBS. For example, there are clear personality factors, there's genetic components, changes in the bugs in the gut, what we refer to as the microbiome. And indeed, IBS can also occur after a episode of gastroenteritis. So enteric infections as well can predispose to long-term symptoms consistent with IBS.
And with a better understanding of IBS, have we seen a change in incidence or prevalence rates for how often people present with IBS in Canada or internationally?
So the prevalence rates vary considerably depending on what definition one uses for the disorder. The current definition that we have is based on that's come from the multinational Rome Foundation. So the Rome Foundation meets every 10 years or so to review the literature in that period that's gone before. and make changes to the definition of IBS. We're currently on the fourth iteration of the Rome Foundation, which again defines the disorder of IBS. So really, depending on the definition, the rates vary. So with respect to the latest data, it suggests that approximately 3.7% of male Canadians suffer with the disorder and 7.8% of female Canadians, with a peak incidence really in early adult life ranging from 18 to 34. But prevalence rates through the rest of the world, we have a similar rate within the UK, but probably a little bit higher in Southeast Asia, for example.
And do we have a good understanding of why those prevalence rates may differ according to different countries, or why they may stay the same across similar countries?
So again, I'll go back to it depends really on the definition one uses. Those figures that I quoted are based on the Rome 4 criteria. But again, I think around differences in terms of how patients present and the risk factors they're exposed to, particularly thinking of sort of gastroenteritis type symptoms.
And are there different classifications of irritable bowel syndrome, or is there only one type?
So there are a number of different subcategories of irritable bowel syndrome. So IBS is a symptom-based diagnosis. So you have to have recurrent abdominal pain for at least a day a week for 3 months. And then two or more of the following, really, that pain is in some way related to defecation and is associated with a change in frequency or appearance of the stool. So usefully we can begin to subcategorize IBS into four subtypes, which are based on the most predominant bowel habit. So the first is IBS with constipation. The second, IBS with diarrhea. There are some patients who cycle between the two, which we refer to as IBS mixed. And then there's a very small proportion of patients who don't quite fit into one of those three aforementioned categories, which we classify as IBS unclassified. But IBSD is probably the most frequent subtype, accounts for approximately 40% of patients. Interestingly, somewhat more common in men than women, but clearly there are considerable geographic and ethnic differences, whereas IBS-C tends to be a little bit more common in females than men.
And we've talked already about the bidirectional circuit of communication, but what do we know about other causes of IBS?
So in terms of other causes of IBS, and we have to remember that the gastrointestinal tract in terms of symptoms doesn't have a very big vocabulary, if I can use that term. So IBS can often masquerade as other disorders, and clearly there are other disorders which you would want to exclude before making that diagnosis. And particularly you think about the red flag symptoms, so namely an older patient, certainly above 50, with weight loss or rectal bleeding. Nocturnal symptoms can often point you towards a more organic diagnosis. Clearly have to think about recent antibiotic use in the context of Clostridium difficile infection, and raised inflammatory markers or fecal calprotectin might point you towards inflammatory bowel disease as the cause. But actually, in real life, the Rome 4 diagnostic criteria have very good receiver operator characteristics. And certainly with some targeted investigations, such as a complete blood count, ferritin, B12, folate, and celiac serology, you can be confident in using these diagnostic criteria in routine day-to-day clinical practice.
So you mentioned some demographic features of those who present and some baseline investigations, which may go into the diagnosis of diagnosing irritable bowel syndrome from the beginning. Can you start me off with a patient who goes in to see his or her family doctor for, let's say, bothersome gastrointestinal symptoms? How does their workup start, and where do you envision that kind of management taking place?
I think the key point to make here really is around taking a detailed history from such a patient. So the aspects to focus on really are the length that the symptoms have been there. So IBS would need at least 3 months of symptoms, excluding those red flag symptoms that I mentioned earlier and really trying to get down to what the most problematic symptom is. And this can vary from patient to patient in the sense that some patients, it's the pain that's driving their healthcare seeking, whereas in others, whilst they still have to have pain to meet the definition, it's also the disordered bowel habit, which is particularly problematic. When you're thinking about corroborating evidence for an IBS diagnosis, patients often have a number of extra gastrointestinal symptoms, if I can call them that. So fibromyalgia can be very, very common, comorbid anxiety and depression as well. So it's taking a very detailed history. Clearly, it's important to ascertain whether there's any initiating factors. So again, particularly thinking of a preceding episode of gastroenteritis, or often a major life event, such as the loss of a relative or the breakdown of a relationship in itself can precipitate symptoms. Clearly, on the physical examination, this would have to be normal. And again, if there are abnormal findings, particularly on palpation of the abdomen, then that would warrant further appropriate investigations. Similarly, with respect to those red flag symptoms, if they're present, then that warrants further workup. But the vast majority of irritable bowel syndrome is actually managed in primary care by family doctors and generally managed very well. The patients that we see in secondary care are those that are perhaps more recalcitrant to standard treatments.
And when you're taking a history, do you find that family history has a role in diagnosing irritable bowel syndrome, or if there's any genetics at play that might be contributing?
Yes, this is a great question. So there is a role of genetics in that patients often have a relative who suffers with irritable bowel syndrome. I think there are a number of very interesting studies really to come out from Rona Levy in the US, looking at concordance rates amongst twins, and it's much higher. IBS concordance rates in identical twins rather than non-identical twins. Similarly, there's some really nice genome-wide association studies from the European group of Beata Niesler, which shows quite nicely that there are a number of genetic associations with IBS. Particularly, one locus has been identified, that 7p22.1, which has a number of genes within it, particularly the KDELR2 gene and the GRID2IP gene, which have shown consistent risk effects for IBS itself. So certainly these studies in combination do suggest there is a genetic component, but also as well around illness behavior as well, that if a parent has IBS and the child sees the parent suffering with IBS type symptoms, and that itself is an independent risk factor for the development of the disorder.
It's really interesting. Thank you. So if you were to see a patient with complex IBS present to you in secondary care, would you have any expectation of what blood or supplementary investigation should be done by that point in time? Or given the fact that the large majority of these investigations will be normal, a referral without any further workup is often fine?
I think some targeted testing can be very useful. IBS remains a clinical diagnosis, but I think some targeted tests, particularly a complete blood count, inflammatory markers, hematinics, and celiac serology are very useful. Again, with the increased availability of fecal calprotectin, a normal fecal calprotectin would suggest that inflammatory bowel disease is not the cause of the symptoms. So I think those sort of investigations to start with as the patient moves from primary and secondary care, from primary care to secondary care, can be very helpful to the secondary care clinician. Clearly, one has to evaluate each individual patient on that basis, and then one may need to think about some more invasive tests if appropriate. I think it is worth mentioning that a third of patients who would meet the criteria for irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea in actuality have a disorder called bile acid diarrhea, In the UK, we have access to CCAT testing to delineate that, but you can also measure fecal bile acids or fecal C4, which can help some of the clues in the history that might push you towards bile acid diarrhea rather than IBS with diarrhea, is the fact that this disorder can be quite prevalent in patients who've had a cholecystectomy. So certainly in the cholecystectomized patient who presents with diarrhea, particularly after surgery, you would maybe think about bile acid diarrhea rather than IBS with diarrhea. And clearly you say, well why is that distinction important? And I would argue, yes, it is, in that those with bile acid diarrhea often respond very well to bile acid sequestrants such as cholestyramine or cholesevelam.
Let's discuss the management of IBS, which can be quite challenging. What role do lifestyle and diet have in managing the symptoms?
So I think this really is the cornerstone of management. I would say that actually the first and most important aspect of management is around patient education. So patients will often come in with a number of preconceived ideas, A, regarding the diagnosis itself and its differential diagnosis, and clearly a number of patients will be worried about an underlying cancer, and you have to really allay those fears in that patient. Similarly, patient education is also very important in terms of educating them as to the nature of the disorder, particularly that symptoms frequently wax and wane. Lifestyle management again is very important in terms of stress reduction, looking for triggers that make the symptoms worse and more bothersome. And really my view is that difficult to treat IBS should be managed within a multidisciplinary team that would include specialist nurses, dietitians, psychologists and psychiatrists occasionally around to try and improve the outcomes in these patients.
Do you find that trigger diaries are useful or particularly helpful in these patients?
Yes, they often are, and there's certainly some triggers that patients self-identify. So particularly some dietary triggers, so particularly intolerance to wheat and gluten-containing products. Clearly, these patients don't necessarily have what we'd refer to as sort of classical celiac disease, but more they have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Similar comments around lactose-containing products, and patients often find going dairy-free or reducing their dairy intake in their diet can be very, very helpful indeed.
And many primary and secondary care physicians will have heard about the rise of low FODMAP diets to treat IBS in recent years. What's the current evidence around recommending a low FODMAP diet, and what does that mean for the patient?
Okay, so FODMAP is an acronym for fermentable oligodimonosaccharides and polyols, and these are essentially fermentable carbohydrates that have a number of effects within the gut. So the first effect is an essentially osmotic effect, so it draws water into the lumen of the bowel. That also causes increased intracolonic fermentation, which causes gaseous distension of the gut, and then combining that with the osmotic effect can cause symptoms in patients. So the sort of food groups that are high in FODMAP contents would be the legumes or fruits, particularly apples and peaches, garlic, onions, and artificial sweeteners. And certainly the meta-analytic evidence suggests that diets low in FODMAPs can be useful in treating IBS patients. However, the quality of those studies can be somewhat variable. I think it is important to be very clear that this is a dietary intervention that needs to be delivered by a registered and trained dietitian. I don't think this is an intervention, because it's so difficult to do, is that you shouldn't just give a diet sheet to a patient and say, get on with it. There is a nice study from Magnus Simran's group in Sweden that shows that the low FODMAP diet isn't any more efficacious than the modified National Institute of Health and Care Excellence diet from the UK. So again, I think it's choosing the patient wisely in terms of dietary interventions, in that actually following a true low FODMAP diet is actually very difficult to do and needs dietitian support.
So we've talked about the major cornerstone of management being advice, stress reduction, and management of lifestyle, along with some potentially very interesting dietary interventions. Is there any role for pharmacological therapy? And if so, should it be guided by symptoms or altogether given to the patient?
So I think that the utility of the Rome 4 criteria is that it does divide patients up into predominant symptoms. And I think, broadly speaking, one can consider three aspects to those symptoms. So there are those symptoms of constipation, and yes, that can be managed very effectively with pharmacological therapy, those with diarrhea, and then those with pain as the predominant symptom. So if we consider constipation in the first instance, I think you've got a number of treatments which can broadly be divided into the simple laxatives versus some of the newer agents. So, for example, psyllium ispergula fiber can be very useful. And then we have our sort of standard polyethylene glycol-based osmotic laxatives, as well as stimulants and stool softeners. When one's considering the more advanced treatments, we have two guanylate cyclase C agonists now on the market, namely finlacotide and placanotide. The utility of those two particular agents is that they have a clear and beneficial effect also on pain. But clearly, as one goes up the treatment pathway, these interventions become more expensive. We also have lubiprostone, which is a chloride 2 channel agonist, which again can be useful, but the effect on pain is somewhat less. When we consider diarrhea, a good intervention for diarrhea is loperamide. Loperamide is an opioid agonist at the mu opioid receptor, but doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, so it doesn't exert any analgesic effect in the central nervous system. But sometimes patients can be quite sensitive to that and get sort of rebound constipation. So my own practice in that context, I often use liquid loperamide, as this allows slightly closer titration. Also available now is eloxagiline, which is a mixed mu opioid and kappa receptor agonist and a delta opioid receptor antagonist. And certainly the phase 3 studies have shown that this could be effective in treating the diarrhea. It also probably has a pain effect, but is contraindicated in patients who've had a previous cholecystectomy because it can cause pancreatitis. Finally, if we just consider pain a little bit, then many of the standard antispasmodics such as pinavarium can be useful. These are essentially smooth muscle relaxants, which can be useful in some patients. Peppermint oil also has a reasonable evidence base, but some patients can get reflux with this. I think one of my go-to medications in terms of treating pain, particularly in irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, are the tricyclic antidepressants, so particularly amitriptyline. And these also have some anticholinergic side effects, which can be useful. So they generally cause some constipation, which obviously, if you're trying to treat diarrhea, is useful itself. And patients also can feel quite sleepy on it. So if the patient is getting nighttime pain, then there can be some utility there. In contrast, in the constipated patient with pain, then the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors such as citalopram can also be useful as well.
Great. And I couldn't let you get away with today without talking about the microbiome. So we know that there's an explosion of research into this field, both clinically and from a research perspective on how we can alter the microbiome to optimize patient outcomes. What's the role for interventions in targeting the microbiome for IBS?
So again, there are a number of studies out there that have demonstrated that the microbiome of the IBS patient is probably different to normal. As yet, we're not entirely clear what the most effective intervention is in this context. We have rifaximin, which is a minimally absorbed antibiotic, and a number of large placebo-controlled trials has shown symptomatic benefit with this treatment. The sort of numbers needed to treat are approaching 11, and whether patients need retreatment over time is as yet slightly unclear. There are a number of studies out there that have evaluated the role of probiotics, whether that be a single strain probiotics or multiple strain probiotics. There's considerable variability in the study designs. Generally, I think they are of some help, and patients can get some benefit from them. And certainly, in terms of this specific patient, my general advice to patients is that, you know, they can try this probiotic for a month or so and see if it helps. But I think if it hasn't helped after that sort of period of time, then they probably aren't going to help. But certainly something that patients quite like to try, because they see it as a way of modulating the microbiota beneficially. And some patients do get a good response to these interventions.
In your experience, do patients ever experience any major adverse events from trialing probiotics?
So by and large, probiotics are very, very well tolerated by patients. Some patients do get some gas and abdominal bloating with probiotics, but by and large, they are well tolerated.
Thank you for that really useful summary of the currently available treatment options. Your review article also talks about psychological therapies. Can you tell me about those?
So as a class of interventions, psychological therapies are effective in reducing symptom burden in IBS. There's certainly a number of specific techniques. So the most common ones include cognitive behavioral therapy, dynamic psychotherapy, and hypnotherapy. Certainly in the UK, one of the challenges with these interventions, which I do think are genuinely very effective, is access to specific therapists who has the skill set to deliver these therapies effectively. But I think if you have a therapist that you have access to, then in themselves they can be very good treatments. I think some of the interesting data that's coming out is that self-administered cognitive behavioral therapy could be useful. And certainly internet-based cognitive behavioral therapy also has an emerging evidence base. So I think it can be a very useful intervention in IBS. I would just point the listeners to a really excellent review article in Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology in 2013. Entitled Psychological Treatments in Functional GI Disorders, a Primer for the Gastroenterologist. And that provides a really useful summary of all the available treatments and the evidence.
And how do you identify which patient would be best suited for a psychological therapy compared to other therapies you're considering?
So really, I think in terms of which patients are going to benefit most, given the resource limitations that we're faced with. I usually reserve these kind of therapies for patients who've been recalcitrant to first or second line drug therapy for between 3 to 6 months. And certainly also as well, you need to be thinking accessing these therapies in patients where you feel there's a significant stress or anxiety component to their symptoms, in that those patients often respond very well to this type of intervention.
You've told us a bit about how self-administered CBT or internet-based CBT, we'll probably see a lot more of that in the future. Are there any more promising treatments or therapies that we think will enter the realm for IBS?
Well, there's a very interesting paper that was recently published that looks at the addition of dietary glutamine in irritable bowel syndrome. So this was specifically in patients who'd had an infection that started their symptoms, so-called post-infective IBS, and it was a randomized controlled trial over 12 weeks where patients were randomized to placebo or the addition of dietary glutamine at a dose of 5 grams three times a day. And certainly there were marked improvements in both abdominal pain and symptom severity scores. And certainly this is a very interesting addition to the armamentarium, but clearly this needs to be replicated in another centre in a larger study.
It's really such a pleasure to have some of your wealth of experience in managing these patients on the CMAJ podcast, so thank you. If you could summarise your top tips or suggestions for primary care physicians and family doctors for how to approach the patient with irritable bowel syndrome, what would you say?
So I think first and foremost, it's really taking a detailed symptom history and really the effect those symptoms have on a patient's quality of life. Because I think if a patient feels listened to with some empathy, in fact, that's half the battle in my experience. I think one needs to also understand and educate the patient in terms of the diagnosis itself. Recurrent and repeated and invasive investigations, generally speaking, are not required. Patients' fears and misconceptions about the natural history of the disorder need to be addressed as well, particularly in the sense that symptoms can relapse and remit over time. Again, one needs to delineate the difference between similar sounding disorders, so IBS versus IBD, so explain to patients that there isn't any inflammation in IBS, and similarly concerns that many patients will have around cancer. There's also important to signpost patients to internet resources of information, particularly salient for your listeners as the Canadian Society of Intestinal Research. I think the problem with a number of documents that are on the internet regarding IBS is they don't necessarily have the scientific and clinical oversight that some more trusted resources do. So they would really be my top tips for managing the IBS patient, but clearly as well addressing and treating the most bothersome symptoms in a rational fashion.
Adam, it's been a pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really, really enjoyed speaking to you.
I've been speaking to Adam Farmer. He's a UK-based gastroenterologist, senior lecturer and clinical director of specialised medicine at Royal Stoke University Hospital in Staffordshire, United Kingdom. To read the review article he co-authored, visit cmaj.ca. Also, don't forget to subscribe to CMAJ Podcasts on SoundCloud or a podcast app, and let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating. I'm Dr. Neil Chanchloni, Associate Editor for CMAJ. Thank you for listening.